This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Newly digitized documents of Abraham Lincoln show the worldview of the young man who would become the President of the United States.
Lincoln is a consensus maker. He is a conservative to a moderate person, generally speaking.
Hear about the latest chapter in the decades-long Lincoln Papers Project from director Dan Worthington. Plus, Illinois State University athletics director Larry Lyons tells you about his really bad joke that all Redbird lives matter, a joke that has prompted athlete boycotts and protest marches. The latest on disaster recovery loans from recent Central Illinois flooding and storms. And hear about the Central Illinois connection to a silent film thought long lost that now is found and saved. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. There are now 9 people hospitalized with COVID-19 in McLean County, including 3 in intensive care. Those 9 hospitalizations are the most in the county since mid-May, when dozens of residents at a Bloomington nursing home contracted COVID-19 in a deadly outbreak. The uptick in hospitalization comes amid a record number of new COVID-19 cases, 760 in the past week, mostly affecting students at ISU. Illinois State University reported 87 new cases today. The total ISU caseload for COVID-positive students is more than 1,100. ISU student athletes plan to march through campus Friday night in support of black athletes who are seeking social change. Pole vaulter Luke Nelson helped organize the event. Nelson is white and says he needs to show support for his black teammates.
I think it's important to not put undue stress on your black peers in such stressful situations. I'd like to see myself as an ally or an accomplice.
The athletics department produced an action plan after a student-athlete boycott began when athletics director Larry Lyons said all Redbird lives matter. Nelson says it's not appropriate for him to comment on the action plan. He says student-athletes have sparked a conversation he thinks will lead to better understanding. A second candidate has announced plans to run for a Bloomington City Council seat next spring. Michael Straza plans to run in Ward 5. That includes neighborhoods north of Veterans Parkway and Empire Street. Straza serves on the city's Zoning Board of Appeals and is involved in 2 startup businesses. He currently works at Vail Church. Straza says he wants to grow businesses in the city and improve infrastructure. Normal Community High School teacher Patrick Lawler previously announced plans to run for the seat. Johnny Painter has represented Ward 5 on the council since 2014. She says she hasn't decided whether she will run again. Governor J.B. Pritzker appears to side with a Republican effort to investigate fellow Democrat and House Speaker Michael Madigan. Pritzker tells reporters he favors more transparency, and he hopes the Republican call for a legislative investigation isn't a political stunt.
This is an extraordinarily important, endeavor that, as I have said all along, there are questions that need to be answered by the Speaker. And perhaps the creation of this legislative committee will actually get some of those answers.
Members of the House GOP have invoked a rule to call for a special committee. It would hold hearings and determine if Madigan should face repercussions, including removal from office. Commonwealth Edison admitted to a bribery scheme involving jobs and payouts to Madigan associates in exchange for passing beneficial legislation. Madigan has not been charged and denies wrongdoing. Illinois unemployment offices remain closed to the public, but Governor J.B. Pritzker says work continues to make sure benefit claims are processed. Some lawmakers say it's time to allow face-to-face service at a time when there is double-digit jobless rates. The Department of Employment Security has experienced problems with its online system. Pritzker says one reason for keeping the offices closed is employees have received threats.
And it makes it much more difficult to maintain their security when we open those offices physically.
Pritzker points out employees are working at the offices and more efforts are being made to reach out to those who have had difficulty filing for unemployment. McLean County has its first positive test for West Nile virus of the year. The county health department says a mosquito pool collected east of Bloomington tested positive for that virus. McLean County is one of 17 counties in Illinois with confirmed West Nile activity. There have been no reported human cases so far. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University Athletics Director Larry Lyons says he is working to better educate himself about the experiences of black athletes as he tries to repair damage caused by his All Redbird Lives Matter remark. Student athletes responded by boycotting team activities. Lyons tells Eric Stock he's doing what he can to rebuild trust.
I apologize to the student athletes. I did not expect to offend them like I did, and I told them I'm sorry. And I told them that I am going to be better and that they deserve better. And we are working toward that now.
Do you see their concern? They want to see understanding of why the phrase is offensive to black people, for how it is used to negate the struggles that they deal with on a daily basis, not just at ISU, but everywhere.
You know, we're listening to their voices. And we're trying to react, and we're trying to get better. There's no question that we all could use some education. I'm committed to that education and to move forward to get better in this athletic department.
One student athlete we talked to said that they felt that the apology that you had responded with on Friday was an attempt at damage control and not something that they felt in and of itself showed a genuine understanding. How do you respond to that, and can you assure student athletes, particularly those of color, that attempts to fix what they see as shortcomings are genuine?
There's only one way to respond. That's through conversation with them, understanding their issues, and then working toward providing solutions and helping make this place better.
Now, administration at ISU Athletics is overwhelmingly white, and of course, the student body at ISU is far more diverse. Is the athletic department out of touch with today's student athletes?
I don't think so. We work very hard to try and find diverse candidates for when we have open positions. That runs in cycles. We've been more diverse in certain units than others. I think one of the things that we're going to focus on is that we can find ways to be more diverse in the support areas that student athletes deal with every day. Athletic training, strength and conditioning, a study center, those kinds of things where they're dealing with those student athletes. There's no question that we need more ethnic diversity on our leadership team. And one of the good things about ISU is you get people to stay here a while. And then that leads to challenges when you do have openings, that how you fill them with applicable candidates. And, you know, an interesting thing, I had the president of MOA reach out to me yesterday, and that's the Minority Opportunity Association within NACTA, which is the overarching professional organization for college athletics. He said, "What can I do to help?" I said, "When we have job postings, you need to help direct folks to our job openings. If they're interested, we need to get them in the pool so that we can judge their qualifications for our particular needs. And we're going to work very hard to do that."
If student athletes say that this plan is not enough, it doesn't address the essence of their concerns, and they may wish to continue the boycott longer, then what?
Well, we're trying to determine from representing voices from all of our teams. What is the reaction to this? The concepts that we laid out in front of them. What is the reaction to their concerns? And we're gathering that. Not all the coaches have had those direct conversations with their student athletes. And they want to do that because they want to be part of the process. So we're still trying to get that information, and we'll react to that. We're going to start rolling on some of this stuff, though. We're going to roll on the education piece. Me personally and our leadership team and our coaches, we're going to try and get some things set up where we can directly access student athletes in terms of the diversity concepts that we laid out there. Some of the staffing issues, I think we can start working on those right away. So we're going to start making some inroads, and then we're going to see where it goes.
One student athlete we spoke with said that it is time for change in administration, and they want you and possibly others to resign. And they feel that the comment was sort of a last straw for them, showing that their experiences as people of color on campus haven't been validated. I mean, you have decades of service to the ISU community and the athletic department. How do you respond to that?
Well, those individuals are certainly welcome to have their opinions. I'm evaluated like everybody else on this campus. President Dietz is my direct supervisor, and they're certainly able, and he would welcome their input into that evaluation.
What is your main takeaway from all of this experience? Certainly the experience isn't over yet. It's still ongoing, but what has been the takeaway for you from all this?
I think the takeaway is, as disappointed as I am that I misstepped when I spoke. The takeaway is a real commitment by our senior staff and by our coaches. And I think there's a real commitment by the student athletes to find ways to get better and address problems. Let's start here in the athletic department and work our way up through the campus and our community. That's our best option, is to do that. And I think there's a commitment to do that. Anytime there's a little tension and you can find ways to improve the situation and get better, then that's a win, and that's what we're going to do.
That is Illinois State University Athletics Director Larry Lyons with Eric Stock. One student athlete at ISU says Lyons' apology and action plan seemed insincere, and it's time for Lyons to resign. A protest march over the remark is set for Friday evening. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the life of Abraham Lincoln has an empty space filled in online. More on that in just a few minutes. The U.S. Small Business Administration is offering low-interest disaster loans for people in McLean, Woodford, Peoria, Tazewell, and other central Illinois counties whose property sustained damage from severe storms and flash flooding in mid-July. SBA Public Affairs Specialist Ayanna Green Garrett tells Joe Deacon who is eligible and how they can apply.
SBA offers long-term recovery assistance in the form of low-interest loans to businesses of all sizes, private nonprofit organizations, homeowners, and renters with property damaged by the disaster.
So how much can be borrowed and what can those funds be used for?
Homeowners can borrow up to $200,000 to repair their primary residence, and renters and homeowners can borrow up to $40,000 to repair and replace personal items, including automobiles. Businesses of all sizes and private nonprofit organizations can borrow up to $2 million to repair or replace damaged business assets such as buildings, inventory, furniture and fixtures, machinery and equipment. In addition, businesses that suffered economic losses due to the disaster may also be eligible for SBA economic injury disaster loans, regardless of whether they sustained physical damage. These working capital loans up to $2 million provide funds for necessary and ongoing expenses until business returns to normal.
How do residents or businesses qualify for these loans? What need do they have to show to be eligible?
An applicant must have a satisfactory credit history and show the ability to repay all loans. SBA also requires collateral for physical loss loans over $25,000 and all economic injury disaster loans over $25,000. SBA will take real estate when it is available. However, if there is a lack of collateral, SBA will not decline a loan, but will require you to pledge what is available.
What are the terms of these loans as far as interest rates and length of the loan?
We offer home loans with interest rates at 1.25%, business loans at 3%, and nonprofit organizations at 2.75%. The loan terms are up to a maximum of 30 years, and the first payment is not due until 5 months from when you sign the closing documents.
What is the process for applying for these loans, and what steps do people need to take?
Due to COVID-19 restrictions, we have coordinated a virtual disaster loan outreach center where applicants can apply online at disasterassistance.sba.gov, or they can contact our Center for 101 Assistance to speak with a representative to help guide them through the process.
What are the application deadlines for these loans?
Applicants will have until October 19, 2020 to submit their application for physical damage and May 19, 2021 for applicants applying for economic injury.
That's Ayanna Green-Garrett of the Small Business Administration. She spoke with Joe Deacon. Green-Garrett says applications don't need to be accepted. So if someone applies, they can turn it down if they decide later. For more details about the program, go to WCBU.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a silent film comes back to life. The head of a long-running effort to make the life of Abraham Lincoln more accessible to the public says they've reached a new milestone. The Papers of Abraham Lincoln Project has added more than 500 documents to complete Lincoln's online record through his one term in Congress in the 1840s. Project Director Dan Worthington says the latest documents come from Lincoln's early political days as an aspiring Whig. During this time, Lincoln became a married man, a father, and moved from state to national level politician. Worthington says those early professional papers include the first reference to his famous House Divided idea, and they show Lincoln's worldview.
This is in 1843, and he is looking to unify the Whig Party. There's been some confusion in the Whig Party and some opposition into the Whig Party to the method for nominating members to serve in positions in the state. So the Whig Party favored a more process by which a convention would select the candidates to serve in both Congress and in the state. There was opposition in the state Whig Party to that position of using a convention as opposed to using the old caucus system where the party leaders got together and selected the candidates. So Lincoln was on the side of using the convention, and so Lincoln is using that metaphor to urge the Whig Party members to get behind the convention process so they can have a united front in battling the Democrats in 1843 and 1844. And they do succeed in that.
What do both references in the later speech and in this letter suggest about Lincoln's worldview?
Well, Lincoln is, I believe, a consensus maker. He is a conservative to a moderate person, generally speaking. He is very much interested in preserving the Union and preserving unity and finding consensus within the party and with the country. So Lincoln's worldview is that extremes are dangerous, either very, very, very right-wing extremes, in this instance, that would be Southerners who want to secede from the Union, who want to break the party system down in the 1840s that are clamoring to expand slavery. He's very opposed to that view because he thinks that's disunifying. But he's also very opposed to the radical view that slavery should be abolished in the 1840s. And he's opposed to the abolitionist view that if the slavery is not ended, the country should be broken up. He is trying to bridge this gap between the very radical segments that are in the country at the time. And that's what he also does in the House Divided speech in 1858. He's talking about the idea that really the country is becoming more and more divided over slavery. And this is not going to turn out well if it continues in this direction. There is going to be civil war. There's going to be a breakup of the Union. The Union's worth keeping. The Union is the best hope for the African American, ultimately, and it's the best hope for ending slavery and leading to equality. If you break up the Union, therefore, African Americans in the South will never get free. They will always be enslaved, and the situation for African Americans in the North will not improve. Racism will dominate if the Union is broken up.
In his years riding the judicial circuit with Judge David Davis of Bloomington, Lincoln was known as a joke teller, a storyteller, a raconteur, a good guy to be around socially. And that may come out in one of the documents that you've just put up, a satirical newspaper column. Tell us about that.
And he writes a lot of satirical things while he's on the circuit. He reverses the letters in the document, and he sort of writes this, and he has the letter that should be in one position. He moves it to another position, so it sort of is a commentary, but it's a satirical commentary or a humorous commentary. He also writes a lot of things in this period that we're talking about that are meant to criticize his opponents.
The Lincoln Papers Project has been going on for a long time, but it's a huge life and a huge person. How many years have you yet to go, do you think?
We're probably looking at another 20 years to complete everything. Now, that sounds like a long time, but this is a fairly traditional thing that has happened in projects that are dealing with presidents, like the Adams Papers, John Adams Papers. They're looking at a 2043 completion date. George Washington Papers, 2054, and they've been going since the 1950s. So we've been going since 1985, and of course Lincoln has a big life, and Lincoln is, because he's the president during the Civil War, he has so many documents coming to him, and there's so many issues that it's a fairly extensive corpus of materials to go through.
Lincoln Papers Project Director Dan Worthington says Lincoln received about 1,700 letters a month during his presidency. Other documents recently digitized by the project include the marriage certificate for Lincoln and Mary Todd, a brief message that is Lincoln's first known use of the telegraph, and the spot resolutions Lincoln introduced in Congress to demand an accounting for what he considered an illegal war against Mexico. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A 1923 silent film, once thought lost forever, was recently rediscovered in a collection donated to the Chicago Film Archives by a Peoria man. Tim Shelley speaks with collections manager Yasmin Desuki about the surprise find of The First Degree and why it's an important one for film buffs.
The film was it's interesting. It was kind of hiding in the middle of this bigger collection that we had, the Cross Collection, that primarily consists of agricultural and sponsored films, and sort of been making our way through it slowly, particularly my colleague, Olivia Babler, and she was working on this film and realized that it was actually a unique print and that it's also a silent film, which is pretty rare for our kind of archive. We don't actively acquire feature commercial production.
This collection actually originally came from Peoria, Illinois, correct?
Yes. It came from Charles E. Cross, who was actually a marketing director at Caterpillar Films at one point. And he had a lot of films in this collection that belonged to C.L. Vinard Productions, which was based out of Peoria. And a lot of these films from Vinard were either produced or distributed by that company, and Charles had a lot of them. It was donated to CFA 2006.
So what are the odds of a film like this surviving? I know a lot of films from this era were on old nitrate film, which could easily burn up or disintegrate or be destroyed. I mean, how did this movie survive 97 years?
Honestly, it's sort of a miracle that this film survived at all. It's incredibly rare for silent films produced during that time to have survived, partially because, as you mentioned, nitrate film is very, let's say, kind of touchy. As soon as there's a change in temperature or something, it's kind of prone to combusting or being, just set aflame. So a lot of films were lost that way. just kind of poor archival practices that plagued the industry in the very beginning when, I mean, there are many different interpretations of this. It was kind of capacity, lack of knowledge about the film stock itself and kind of the drawbacks of each kind, but also probably a general lack of understanding that this would end up being, you know, another major art form of the 20th century. So archival practices were poor, and especially, I mean, for a Universal silent film to survive, it's deeply, deeply rare, because Universal has the poorest survival rates of all Hollywood film studios. Only 15% of their films survive, and because partially due to a practice that they had where they would destroy a lot of the silent film negative, and that happened in 1948.
So what do we actually know about the film, I mean, itself?
It's primarily a melodrama focusing on Sam Purdy's own trials and tribulations, and it's told primarily in flashback. So it sort of has this Cain and Abel kind of retelling of a brother, of a sibling rivalry. And it's also based on a short story by George Cthulhu, who, I mean, the story was called The Summons, and it was published in the Saturday Evening Post in 1914.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
That's Tim Shelley's interview with Yasmin Dasuki of the Chicago Film Archives about the film The First Degree, donated to the archives by a Peoria man. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Eric Stock, Tim Shelley, and Joe Deacon. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Subscribe to Sound Ideas on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or NPR One. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.